We keep rolling now on the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's 12:08. This is John Williams. Pete Zimmerman is our producer on the Wintrust Business Lunch as we look at the financial scene. We look at the big picture. We look at the little picture. Let's start with Mark. Thanks for joining us again. Mark Hamrick's on the phone line. He is the Washington Bureau Chief and Senior Economic Analyst at Bankrate. Let's start with the big picture with you, Mark. What are you seeing about jobless numbers first?
Sure, John. Good to be with you. Of course, every Thursday, these numbers have taken on much more significance for the last 5+ months, and this is the new claims for unemployment benefits. And in the latest week, we remained above 1 million new claims, down by about 100,000 from the previous week. So we're not making a lot of progress here. We're still seeing about 27 million total Americans basically making a claim of some kind in the latest week. That includes, or in the latest measure, I should say, that includes the pandemic insurance program as well. So, you know, we're still very much in the thick of this economic downturn, and, you know, we're getting closer now to the time when we'll get the August employment report, and that'll tell us where we stood for the nation as a whole. I should mention, state of Illinois was one of the exceptions where we saw an increase. Many of the states did report decreases in new claims this week, and so in Illinois, we're up by 3,000, 25,000.
An increase in jobless claims, that is
exactly,
still
yes.
More people unemployed in Illinois. What happens for us to get back to work? If a vaccine becomes available, then people can with confidence interact again, and then businesses could go back into play? Is that kind of what needs to happen?
Well, that's obviously an important step in the right direction, but that doesn't put people back on airplanes. That doesn't give people the income that they lost during this time. It simply gives them an added degree of confidence about the ability to avoid COVID-19. And obviously there are going to be questions about the effectiveness and longevity of the vaccine. We don't know the answers to that yet because we don't know which vaccines we'll get access to. But that's obviously, I think, the most important thing. And you know, we hope and pray that we get there sooner rather than later.
Also talk to me a little bit about the Fed and interest rates. They're going to stay lower, right? Or stay low.
Yeah. This is really, ultimately, you know, important things that the Federal Reserve and Chairman Jerome Powell are discussing today, but they're immensely complicated, to be blatantly honest about it, and so it's really on all of us to try to break it down. Chairman Powell delivering a virtual speech today, whereas in the past it tends to be a consequential appearance for the Fed chairman to speak at Jackson Hole, a conference organized by the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. And over the years, whether it was Chairman Bernanke or Chair Yellen or now Chairman Powell, they tend to use this gathering as a way of signaling something important about what the central bank is doing. So this was widely anticipated this morning, and essentially what Chairman Powell is saying is this. In the future, the Fed will be a little more flexible about how it views this question of a so-called 2% inflation target. And in the past, there was sort of an idea that it would need to pull the interest rate trigger, meaning move rates higher, as soon as it sees the in the whites of the eyes of inflation getting at a 2% level. Essentially, they're signaling more flexibility on that, and that probably means that for all of us, interest rates are going to stay lower for longer. Obviously, if there were sign of a tremendous or dramatic sign of burgeoning inflation, the Fed would move, but most of us believe that we're a long, long way away from that. And indeed, Powell said today that he thinks the bigger threat is essentially a deflationary spiral because, you know, we have an economy that's experiencing historically high unemployment. That isn't the environment where essentially firms feel like they can raise prices. Wages aren't going to be spiking anytime soon either, unfortunately.
Yeah, if you have a little bit of money, you're able to buy a little bit more now, but too many people don't have more money. What is the downside of low interest rates?
Good question, and it's one that I, John, do ask about as often as is reasonable at Federal Reserve news conferences, and I've attended the bulk of them going back to the first one that was held in 2011, and that is, as the Fed basically pushes this lever to keep rates low to try to keep the economy as strong as possible in environments like this, there are unintended consequences, and I tend to ask, you know, what do you think about the fact that savers are the unintended casualties of record low interest rates? And the answer tends to be fairly consistent, and that is that for us to help the economy broadly, interest rates are the major tool for that, and effectively, paraphrased, if they're hurt by that, it's regrettable, but it's necessary.
Is that a trade you're comfortable with?
Well, I guess we haven't found a sufficiently elegant solution, but I think, you know, in the work that we do, John, you and I think it's important for us to point these discrepancies or differences out, because obviously every day on your show repeatedly we talk about, for example, the S&P 500 and that as being, you know, one measure of the success of the financial markets as well as the broader economy. But as we know, there are disconnects between that and all corners of the economy. And as we, you know, essentially celebrate low interest rates, we do need to remember that, you know, there's someone who might be retired who had really been hoping that rates would be higher by now because they would get a better return on their savings.
I understand that.
That's not what they're getting.
But I'm glad that you mentioned that, because I was about to say I am so used to interest rates being low, ridiculously low, that I would not expect to get 7% on my money in the bank. But that has happened in people's lifetimes, and too bad for them, right? Too bad for all of us in that case.
Well, and you would hope that there's a narrow gap between the inflation that people really experience and the level of return that they get from their savings, right? Because we know that by broad measures, inflation is quote-unquote low, but that doesn't apply to shelter, doesn't apply to health care costs, doesn't apply to the cost of education, and so those things have outsized impacts.
Mark Hamrick, Washington Bureau Chief, Senior Economic Analyst, can you tell? At Bankrate, visit bankrate.com. Appreciate your expertise, Mark. Let's talk again.
Always my pleasure, John. Thank you for having me.
1219, this is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. Editor-at-large at CNET. Visit CNET.com to find Ian Schur. Ian, I've got questions for you, sir.
I might have answers.
You always do. Microsoft brings transcriptions to its Word documents, at least the app. They didn't already have this?
Right. I think that's what a lot of us thought when we heard about it. The interesting thing here is that not only is it a feature that a lot of people have been asking for a long time, and I'm talking about people inside Microsoft, people outside of Microsoft, even Microsoft's own executives. And so now that they have it, it's extremely limited. It's very interesting. It only works on the web version of Microsoft Word, so, you know, it's kind of their competitor to Google Docs. And you have to be a subscriber to Microsoft 365, their subscription service, to be able to use it. It doesn't work in the app for your desktop. It doesn't work in the app for your phone or tablet, although they say it might by the end of this year. And it doesn't have a lot of features that competitors like Google and Otter, I don't know if you've ever heard of them, OTTER.AI, that's one I use, they have features like being able to search and being able to share more easily and all sorts of stuff like that. By comparison, Microsoft's is really kind of basic. So we'll see if they make things better, but right now it's a very weird decision they made to make a big deal out of being so late and so far behind.
How does it work, or how do these other transcription services work?
Fortunately, they all work kind of the same. So if you've used one, you kind of used them all. When it comes to Microsoft's app, what happens, we have an image on CNET to show you. When you're in the Word document, there's literally a button that you can hit that will allow you to record the audio that the microphone from your computer picks up. So if you're on a Zoom call or if you're in the middle of a meeting, you can just hit record and your microphone will pick up the sound. You can also take a recording you made and upload it to Microsoft, and that way they'll be able to transcribe it. They only let you upload 5 hours a month, though. Again, you're paying for this. So that is, all the other ones basically work the same, although in a lot of cases, like Otter and Google, they use your phone, which makes it a lot more convenient when you're everywhere else.
Could I transcribe a podcast?
You could transcribe anything, right? And that's one of the great things about this technology is that Transcription services have gotten really good these days. I don't know if you know. In fact, we learned during one of the hearings on Capitol Hill that the president's team actually uses transcription services powered by artificial intelligence to keep track of some of his phone calls. So this is something that's very common nowadays, and it works relatively well.
Well, I think that voice to text, which is essentially what this is, right? Technology is that's in my list of the top three all-time inventions, along with the seedless watermelon and the plaid thermos. The fact that we so take it for granted that you can talk into your phone and text as you go, and it's really remarkably accurate. You know,
it is. Although I will say, I've never taken a seedless watermelon for granted. I'm always thankful.
If you grew up eating seeded watermelons, having to eat around that layer of seeds, do not take that for granted. That is. Let's move on.
I don't know if I can stick with you on the plaid, though.
There was a survey out. It said 75% of us believe Twitter and Facebook are censoring our political views. That's a Pew study. Are they censoring our political views?
I mean, that is, I think, the key question of our age right now. And I think, and honestly, if we took a show of hands of everyone listening, you could probably guess the politics of whoever says yes or no. And that's partially because an entire political party has decided to go up against social media to try and make a point that they believe they're being treated unfairly, right? The president says all the time he feels like social media treats him unfairly, even though he has a platform on it and he's one of the most followed people. And it's just kind of one of these very odd things about American discourse right now. What's interesting, actually, and, you know, one of the things the Pew survey did not talk about, but we've written about on CNN many times, is that there's a perception among some academics that, in fact, the result of all of this debate that's going on and this very perception, 75% of people believe Twitter and Facebook are censoring political views, has caused them to actually limit the amount of moves they make, right, and actually try to pull back from when they push on something. So this is part of the concern when we see, you might have heard the Kenosha shooter was on a Facebook group, and one of the things that happened was people had actually warned Facebook about it, and it didn't take that group down before the shooting, but it did afterward. So we've got a lot of issues to kind of work through here about what is acceptable, what isn't, what the job of these social networks is, and so on.
Yeah, I mean, if Kyle Rittenhouse is on a Facebook group and they're saying something incendiary, is it protected speech or is it fair trade? Better that they talk there than act out? I mean, I need to.
It's tough. I mean, I will tell you the easy answer is that the First Amendment only keeps the government from silencing you. It does not control what companies can do. And Facebook and Twitter and YouTube have rules. They've written them down. I've written about them many times. And part of the problem here is that there is a big gulf between what their rules say and what they do. And it's caused a lot of us to debate what they should do. And that is part of the problem that exists here. But I've also talked to people who are, you know, who work at these companies, and they say to me, look, if we followed the rules to the letter, there are large swaths of users who we'd have to kick off our platform. And they don't want to do that.
Talk to me a little bit about Facebook's anticipation of the election not going smoothly.
Yeah, this is another really interesting story that we have on CNET. So there is concern among some people at Facebook that social media may be used in the days after the election to sow doubt about whether the election was legitimate. And there is one person in particular, President Trump, who is talking about how he doesn't trust mail-in voting now, and if he loses, it's got to be because the election was rigged. These are actual quotes. And so as a result, now Facebook and, it turns out, some of the other social media companies as well are trying to come up with ways to say, okay, well, how do we make sure our social networks are not used as tools to further undermine democracy? And that's a really tough conversation. I wish they'd had it maybe a couple of years ago and not a couple months before the election, but at least they're having this conversation. The sad part is we're never going to know what they came to the decision on. We're just going to see how they act or don't act, and then we're going to have to deal with it afterward.
In other words, deleting accounts or flagging posts that say the election was rigged, something like that?
Or even turning off an account, right? Like, one thing Twitter does that a lot of the others don't is that it actually limits an account for 12 or 24 hours if they break the rules. So imagine if they set rules that said you can't undermine the election or sow doubt about it for the next 36 hours, and, you know, the president puts out a tweet or someone else puts out a tweet, and they have to shut off that account. It would cause a huge stir, but also we'd be in the middle of a really interesting and kind of stressful crisis. So I don't know what the right answer is. Also, I'm not a billionaire running these companies, so, you know, I'm curious to see what they're doing.
Talk to me a little bit about facial recognition and where that technology is today.
Yeah, so one of the things we all kind of have realized is that if you have an iPhone or you have a Samsung phone that's more modern, you can't unlock your phone with your face anymore, right? All the facial recognition technology is kind of broken if you're wearing a mask and you're out and about. And this is a problem. So there have actually been people who have been working on creating computer programs that will be able to identify you even if you're wearing a mask. And no surprise, right now they're all kind of not working. And this is a problem for you and me because it's annoying. I can't unlock my phone easily anymore, and I definitely get annoyed at that when I'm at the grocery store. But there's also larger conversations about, for example, policing. They use a lot of facial recognition these days to identify suspects. And now, if we can't trust these things when the masks are on, what might happen, right? How could that affect that type of issue? It's also being used more and more as a way to identify people who come into government buildings or come into corporate buildings. Mm-hmm. And once again, it's an issue. So it's interesting to see, and it's worth remembering that this technology took decades to invent, so it's not going to happen tomorrow.
Why do you use facial recognition to unlock your phone?
Because it's easier, A. And B, it's actually, Apple argues, more secure than using a code. They say that it's a 1 in 1,000,000 chance that someone has the same face as you, and it's much more likely if my code is something that I would remember, like a wedding date or my address or what a lot of people do, right? It's more likely people could actually hack into your phone that way.
Mm. So you, I've never done that. Do you use your camera function to take a picture of yourself? Is that how that works?
If you have an iPhone, it actually sends out infrared dots all over your face. We have a picture on CNET of what it looks like. It's really cool. And what it does is it actually measures your face, kind of the geography of it, kind of like it's a mountain range, and it creates a special signature for what your face looks like. And that's what it looks for every time you unlock your phone. It's not actually looking at your face. So suddenly I get a really bad sunburn and I'm suddenly like deep red, or if I am in the mud, right, or something like that. I mean, just imagine examples that could happen. Oftentimes it can still unlock my face with my face. Wow. And that's super cool.
Yeah.
It's magic. Check your bank account. That's how I do Apple Pay. That's how I look at my 401k.
Seriously, with facial recognition?
Facial recognition. I don't have to remember a password or anything like that.
What if you grow a beard or shave your beard?
It works okay, but it doesn't always work.
Yeah,
it depends on how you grow a beard, and all of us are, of course, different about it. We actually have a video on CNET where we try all sorts of costume props to see how far we can go with it. Yeah.
Ian Schur is the editor-at-large at CNET, CNET.com. Thank you, Ian.
Absolutely. Take care.
12:35 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. John Williams here. Our next guest is Daniel Blank. He is the founder of The Place for Children with Autism. The website is theplaceforchildrenwithautism.com. Daniel, thanks for joining us. You're on WGN Radio.
Thank you for having me. The last time we talked, we were talking about that 30 seconds of quiet gratitude implemented.
Yeah, you were actually running a commercial on this radio station that was almost entirely devoid of any spoken words. It was just a peaceful piece of music and then a note from you, the sponsor, on that. I think we were all the beneficiaries of that. And our Bob Cerrato in the morning has virtually copied that. He does a musical moment of Zen every day.
No, that's wonderful. I was going to say, now we need 30 seconds of peace.
Just quiet.
This world, we just need some peace. Anyway, it's great to be here.
So let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, you are in the business of creating peace for individuals with autism, I guess families as well. Just from a business standpoint, let's talk about that first. How's business for you? Are people still reaching out to your service?
Yeah, I mean, back in March, we were ahead of when there was the shutdown. We decided to shut down a little bit early. And, you know, there was a shock, obviously, because nobody had expected this. But we quickly pivoted, and we were able to switch to telehealth. And then we took the time to get the safety issues right. So we that was the top priority, is that we, if we were going to reopen our centers, we had to make sure that everybody felt safe. And that took a good 2 months to implement. We had to redesign our buildings. We had to put in different safety measures. We had to acquire PPE for everyone. And that was the only way that we could reopen. And so far, we opened in May, and we have had no issues. We've gotten a tremendous amount of compliments from our families and our employees about how safe they feel. But it does look different. And we went from, you know, having to temporarily lay people off to where we're almost back to full now. And we actually have plans to open new centers now. So we survived. And we did it all on our own. We didn't have to ask for any assistance. We were able to do it all on our own.
Well, I'm glad to hear all of that. For those who haven't heard your previous conversations with us, describe your centers. Are they like schools? Are they like rehabilitation centers? How do they work?
We work only with children ages 2 to 6, because with autism, when you work with a younger child, the success rate, the outcomes is far greater than if you intervene when a child is older. So the earlier a child can get treatment, and we do what's called ABA therapy. We do it one-on-one, but we had a model where we were also doing some group work, but obviously because of COVID, we can't do that, so we've had to pull back from that. But our focus is entirely on the outcomes. And you know, quite frankly, we have a lot of children who come to us who are nonverbal, and then within a certain amount of time, we get to the place where the communication is there. And if I were going to list what, you know, for most parents, what the most important thing is it's that communication. I mean, we've had parents tell us that for the first time their children have said their names. So that's the area that we work in. But there's also a relevance, I think, right now to where we work. Our mission is to serve underserved communities, and we were able to leverage the Affordable Care Act to work in underserved communities. And, you know, there's a question that I always ask myself, is why do we have a world where a child with autism receives treatment based on their socioeconomic circumstances? And why would we allow children to grow up with disabilities that are treatable? And our mission is to level that playing field. Our mission is to make sure that every child, no matter where they're born, can receive treatment. So we are in areas that most providers do not want to go to, if not all. And so we're really, you know, in a lot of challenged neighborhoods.
I have time for one last question, and that is, what's the flag, the first red flag for a parent that their child might be autistic?
That's an interesting question, because mothers tend to be the ones that recognize it first. It usually is like there's no eye contact, there's no response. And usually with an infant, you will see some sort of contact, some sort of response. And a lot of times, although it's getting better, a lot of times a parent will be the first one to notice it, go to a doctor and say, I think that there's something wrong. I think it used to be where a doctor would say, well, just give it more time. Mm-hmm. And I think now the testing is getting earlier. If you can get a child diagnosed at age 2, and you work with this child for a couple of years, you can make all the difference in the world. So we encourage early detection, early intervention. We feel that that can change the course of autism.
Daniel Blank is the founder of The Place for Children with Autism. I got that website right?
Theplaceforchildrenwithautism.com. Yes, you did.
How fortunate for you that was available. Theplaceforchildrenwithautism.com. is the perfect way to remember this business. Daniel, continued success, and boy, who wouldn't support that mission? I'm glad you're out there doing what you do.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
You'll hear from him again here on WGN Radio. It's 1241, the place for children with autism.com. Let's go into the WGN Radio newsroom. More business news now with Steve Bertrand.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. Abbott says it will start shipping its new 15-minute COVID test within the next couple of weeks. And they hope to manufacture 50 million tests a month by the end of October. The aim is to meet a surge in demand for Americans seeking to return to in-person schoolrooms and work. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows says the Trump administration is looking into executive actions to help airline workers facing furloughs if Congress doesn't approve assistance in a new round of stimulus. Speaking to Politico, he says hopefully they can help the airlines and keep some of those workers from being furloughed. So is Chicago's tourism season going to end early? Navy Pier's closing next month. We already knew that. Now the Tribune says Wendella Boats is thinking about docking its sightseeing ships early. That's the Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Steve Bertrand.
Maureen Samuelson joins us now with a look at some agribusiness news. Go ahead, O.
Okay, a green screen on the grain market today, doing quite well. September wheat, for example, is up 9.5 cents a bushel. September corn is up 3.5 cents a bushel. And September soybeans currently trading 20 cents a bushel higher. At the Mercantile Exchange, livestock futures today, mixed. We find the December lean hog contract is trading 2 cents higher per hundredweight. The August live cattle contract is down $1.10 a hundredweight, and the August feeder cattle contract down $0.5 a hundredweight. Pretty good soybean sales again this morning, soybeans and corn. The Department of Agriculture reported private exporters sold 140,000 tons of U.S. corn, destination unknown. But then there's another sale of 747,000 bushels of corn. That destination is China. And yesterday, China bought 400,000 tons of soybeans. The Illinois Soybean Association has announced the promotion of several employees and the creation of a new foundation. Brian Hansen, who has been serving as the organization's chief financial officer, will now add chief operating officer. And I particularly wanted to notice the communications director, Rachel Peabody, been promoted to Director of Communications, and she's the lady that keeps me posted on what's going on. Meanwhile, crop damage, well, we're assessing a new area now. We assessed 2 weeks ago the derecho here in the Midwest, but the hurricane coming ground during the morning hours now is causing crop damage to crops grown in Texas and in Louisiana. So again, we'll have to start reassessing the crop damage to that part of the country. And that's your money on 720 WGN.
The business news continues on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Amy Guth. Hi, Amy.
Hi, John. How are you today?
Pretty good, although I think you're about to go over my head if you're going to talk about what's going on at Argonne and Fermi.
Well, it's over my head, too. That's why very smart people are in charge of running this project. But this is really interesting, and it has huge economic implications for Chicago. So the Department of Energy has picked these two places, or Argonne and Fermilab, to each receive $115 million over the next 5 years to bring quantum computing into more development, to do more development around it. So here's kind of the simplest way that I have been, that quantum computing has been explained to me, because it was over my head as well. It essentially uses atomic particles instead of transistors to move information around. So it has the potential to share more information, larger pieces of data, and more securely than what we do now. So obviously the pharmaceutical industry is very interested in this, financial markets, banking industries, very, very interested in this, and in fact have made investments in this area. But the Department of Energy has picked 5 sites nationally, and that 2 will be in Chicago is really huge. So the implication that, you know, we have these 2 and we could be, you know, it could really make a lot of impact for what's happening here in the tech realm, along with some other developments that we have. You know, we have the DPI Center going in the South Loop. We have all these things happening that really is kind of setting Chicago up to be this huge hub in the tech world, which I think is really fascinating, and there'll be a lot of news coming out of this, I'm sure.
Argonne and Fermilab, when you think about atomic energy or development, you think about the University of Chicago. Is the U of C involved in this project then, too?
They are. Just about all of the schools around here are getting a piece of this, and some have contributed funding. U of I, Urbana-Champaign is part of this, U of C. I think everybody wants a stake in this, and it's going to be really interesting. Particularly the focus here for now will be to develop it, because as the person, in fact, who is leading this initiative, who it's being called the Q Next Initiative, the person that's leading that, you know, he was saying, we're just now kind of on the edge of quantum computing. This is sort of the dawn of it. It's only up from here. There's so much we still have to learn. So I think the focus is what it sounds like anyway. The focus in Chicago is going to be a lot on what are the practical things needed to keep expanding and develop quantum computing, and how are the ways it can serve us.
Talk to me a little bit about the airline industry. What's the news on that front?
Well, I've got two things for you today about Boeing. One is about commercial airlines from Boeing, the 737 MAX, which, of course, has been grounded since March of last year following two fatal crashes and has had so many shoes dropped since then with Boeing. A big jump happened today, and that was, so it's a big step forward. The European Union Aviation Safety Agency, which is basically the FAA there, they said they're going to be doing some flight simulator training in the UK with European pilots this week. And then next week, these pilots are going to fly to Canada to do some test flights. So part of what this recertification process has run into with Boeing is the travel restrictions. You couldn't bring pilots to certain places to have them do these test flights. But they're going to go to Canada. They're going to do these flights. This happened 2 months ago in the U.S. These test flights did happen. There's still some other hurdles to overcome before the grounding is lifted, but this is a really big one because of the European stake in this. So that's a big part. On the complete other end of things for Boeing, this is very interesting. So their Starliner test flight, they have said they're going to be doing another uncrewed, so just the cabin, just the aircraft, not people, an uncrewed test flight of their CST-100 Starliner by the end of January. If you recall, they were set to do this flight. A lot of technical issues got in the way. And in the interim, SpaceX, helmed by Elon Musk, jumped ahead with a lot of fanfare. A lot was going on social media and on broadcast during that launch that sent two astronauts to the International Space Station. So that's a big jump. That's a big development for them. That if they meet that goal, it's a big deal for NASA. Fired the space shuttle. What we've done to get American astronauts to the International Space Station is passage for them on Russian vehicles. So NASA really wants this piece back, and this is potentially a very big revenue point. Now, they're also looking into what does that mean for commercial space travel, which is still still very Jetsons to me still, but nonetheless, they are looking to target some wealthy tourists. So if this test goes according to plan by the end of January, they're going to schedule a manned, a crewed flight to test that. And then I think that kind of the commercial piece of space travel will kind of be on. There'll be some competition between Boeing and SpaceX to see kind of some one-upmanship happening.
I have to say that since the space shuttle's retirement, we have been shuttling our astronauts to and from on Russian spacecraft. Is a little factoid that only recently did I hear. And the more I hear it, the more surprised. You know, I think that hurts our civic or national pride a little bit. That's just amazing to me. Elon Musk has picked up some of the slack, but it's interesting to me that that was something we had to go elsewhere to get done.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, I think there's a big challenge here for Boeing, because not only did SpaceX jump ahead after Boeing hit these challenges with the Starliner, but they really went all out. There was so much fanfare. There was even conversation and think pieces about the design of the aircraft that shuttled the two astronauts to the space station. I mean, they really went all out, and there was a lot there. So there's a big challenge ahead for Boeing on many fronts, but this is one of them. I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in January, because if that uncrewed flight is successful, then it's kind of on, right? The race is sort of on. But I, too, found it really interesting that that we have been booking passage on Russian aircraft when that was a rivalry in the space race before. Now we're looking at this rivalry domestically. So it'll be a big feather in the cap of NASA if Boeing can pull this off.
Yeah, better we fight it here. So Hurricane Laura, 20-foot storm surge, 150-mile-an-hour winds, started out when it at least hit land in Cameron, Louisiana, as a Category 4 storm. It's been downgraded to, last I saw, was a 2. Actually, I think it's now a Cat 1 now that it is inland. But what are you hearing about the damages or the economic impact from that?
Yeah, that's something I'm going to be watching really closely in the days ahead. That number starts going up rapidly after a storm makes landfall and starts to decrease in category. So, of course, once it hits land, it starts decreasing really rapidly. But behind it, there's this wake of damage. Hurricanes are very expensive. Hurricane Irma a couple of years ago, that recovery was in excess of $85 billion in Florida. And Hurricane Harvey in Texas, that was over $108 billion with a B. Like, those are big, big numbers. So when we're talking about Texas and Louisiana, already impacted by COVID quite a bit, and a factor in this other piece of it, and that is such a significant number of oil refineries that serve the U.S. are in Port Arthur and southwest Louisiana. The protocol is that they close down a couple of days prior to a storm hitting, and then that creates some disruption in the pipeline, as it was. So we will probably see, I think a lot of analysts have been kind of out this morning and even in the days prior to it making landfall saying, hey, if depending on impact, we might see gas prices rising as a result of this. But, you know, what it really set to do was interrupt the, U.S. prices for oil and gas that were kind of set to end this three-session streak of gains. So I think that's the big impact is of what it's going to do to petroleum, gas prices, oil, barrels, all of those things. But then on top of that, we have to look at the small businesses impacted. We have to look at housing and so much economic impact on the ground in the wake of a hurricane on top of a moment in which, you know, the U.S. economy is already so impacted, particularly in these two states, which saw really big surges of COVID cases.
I'm going to make a list of things bad that haven't happened in 2020. I think that would be easier to keep. I mean, I was talking to our former producer, Beth Swerk, who lives and works in San Francisco, actually in Sausalito, right across the bay there. And she was talking about the fumes, the ash and the smog in the air from the fires in California. It's a great inconvenience for her. At least San Francisco isn't on fire, but 100 miles north they are. And it's just put so much more pressure on people's lives. Add to that the pandemic, add to that the economy. In other cities, it's great civil unrest that's a layer of additional angst for people. And I guess now on the Gulf Coast, they've got hurricane season bearing on them, and one of the hardest ones to hit landfall in the United States in a century.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I was, you know, watching last night as it was making landfall, and really, it was remarkable. You know, some of the videos coming out of the area of structures and vehicles. There's one of an RV just kind of being tossed like a top. It was really significant, very high winds. So watching that recovery in the days ahead and kind of what that total is going to be for that recovery, that's going to be really significant. Of course, we're still pretty early in hurricane season.
I don't know if our listeners are seeing gas prices jump already. It seems like sometimes it is that reactionary. Are you hearing that? Will we see a change at the thing today or tomorrow?
It doesn't seem like it's going to be that quick. So one analyst, I think he was on Bloomberg, he was talking about this very topic of kind of what the length is in the pipeline of how long it takes to see a disruption in or a change in gas prices after you see a refinery or several refineries shutting down. And it didn't seem, you know, he indicated it didn't seem like it was that immediate. A lot depends on how quickly they open up. So when we're looking at damage to those structures, when we're looking at storm surge of when it's even safe to return to them, those are all kind of pieces they have to factor in. Of course, there's a chemical fire that erupted earlier today just outside of Lake Charles, which is an area that has a lot of focus on it right now around the hurricane where it made landfall. You know, so there's all these pieces that have to be coordinated. So I think it's probably too soon to tell, but it's something I'm going to be watching closely.
Yeah, feel free to text it to us, 312-981-7200, if you see prices change in the near future. Amy Guth, stay well. Thanks for your time, Amy.
Thanks so much, John. You too.